Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. The bill on the agenda for today is Senate File 481, Low Emission Vehicle California Standards Adoption. What we're going to do, members, and we had caucus, and that kind of ran over and took our committee time. And this is a pretty lengthy bill, and I know there's a lot of testimony. So what I'd like to just plan on doing today is get through as much of the testimony as possible and then lay the bill over, and that will leave time at another hearing for additional testimony should we need more time. But this is good. I knew we were going to need all of our time to begin with, and now we're 20 minutes into our scheduled hearing time, and so I'm not sure if we're going to get that all the way through. So we will lay this bill over at the end of the hearing in case we need more testimony.
Mr. Senator Chair, Bickerman. I think that's a good decision because there's some ethanol parts of this bill that we maybe need to look at as the chairman of the Ag Committee.
Yep. So. Yep. Okay, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. There is a delete everything amendment, the A1 amendment, that I believe is in the packets to make the bill conform with the way the House had prepared the bill last week, which were changes that we wanted to offer as well.
We'll pass that out. This is an author's amendment that'll get it in the shape that he desires. Senator Scogan, we'll move the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Marty.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill would deal with greenhouse gas problem, global warming problem, in a way that follows up very nicely with what the legislature did last session when we adopted the Next Generation Energy Act. It sets very strict reduction goals for greenhouse gases in the state, and I think they're very ambitious, and we know it's going to put pressure on, it's going to stress the utilities, the co-ops, the munis. They're going to have to stretch in order to reach that. The greenhouse gases emitted from transportation sector are a big chunk of the issue, and we have to do similar steps in this area. If we don't go as far in this area, we're going to put more pressure on other generators of greenhouse gases. The utilities, again, we're going to have to put more pressure on agriculture, other areas where there is pressure right now to try and change things. So every sector of the economy is going to have to do its share in order to get to address the greenhouse gas issue that the legislature decided last year to do. In terms of regulating greenhouse gases from automobiles, we have two choices. The federal government since 1970 has regulated automobile emissions, and we are, as a state, under those standards. They obviously didn't want 50 different states with 50 different standards, so auto manufacturers have to have 50 different types of cars. But California was ahead of the federal government. They had standards that have always been stricter than the federal government's at the time the federal government passed that. So they allowed California to have an exemption, and other states, because they've got two types here, other states are allowed to piggyback on what California's standards are. So Minnesota has the choice that that California standards or the EPA standards, both of which have been evolving over the years. California seems to be several steps ahead, and the federal government is slowly moving in that direction. This bill would simply move Minnesota, like I believe 12 other states have done already, to adopt the California standards. I think there are actually 18 states that are in the process of moving there. Some of them are doing it through administrative action. They do not need legislation. So we would be behind those other 18 states in doing this. But we would be taking a big step forward in terms of greenhouse gas reductions. This is a bill, I want to make clear from the start, is not about energy efficiency and fuel reductions, because the federal government is the sole entity that's allowed to regulate the gas mileage standards. This bill does have the impact of improving gas mileage, but the point of this bill is to redress the greenhouse gases and reduce them. In doing so, cars are more efficient when we are trying to reduce the greenhouse gases. It costs a bit more to meet the 2012 standards. In California, they estimate it would cost, a typical car payment would go up by about $7 per month for higher costs for the new technology. However, at $3 a gallon, consumers would be saving about $31 a month on the typical car, so you'd have a net savings of $24 per month from the beginning if we adopted the California standards. By 2016, they have tougher standards, which cost more to implement. That would be about $20 per month, but again, the savings are more significant then, too, so you're still having a net savings for the consumer month after month because the cars reduce the use of energy. In terms of one of the concerns you're going to hear from, and that is that we're having an unelected board in California determine Minnesota law. And again, as we do now, we have two choices, as I said. We can go with the EPA standards or the California ones, and we can switch. Well, we can pick the better one. We think the California one is better and worth changing. If California would do something we don't think is responsible or is a problem for us, we can switch back to the federal standards. However, if you look at California, they've been responsible. When they set the standards to move forward in greenhouse gases, they were required to do it in the maximum feasible, realistic manner they could. So they took the fleet, the company that had the heaviest automobiles, the ones that would have the most difficulty reaching it, and they said, we're going to make sure that they can meet the standards without changing the mix of vehicles. And you're going to hear from people saying, oh, this means this is going to take away your trucks, your pickups. It's going to take away bigger vehicles, but it doesn't need to do so because the standards were set up so it wouldn't. In fact, the auto industry will be able to meet these standards. And in terms of E85, one of the issues that's been raised as well, this should actually have a positive impact on it because the E85 vehicles get a double credit. They get a credit because their fuel puts out less carbon emissions, and because it's clean fuel vehicle, they give it a double credit, so it actually will encourage the use of E85 vehicles. We can, as I said, count on the fact that Minnesota can move back and forth. We don't expect to move back and forth, but if California's, quote, unelected board would do something that we feel causes problems with our fuel supply, our use, we could do so. But in terms of the use of trucks, the pickups, and the fact that we're an agricultural state and a forestry state, and we use more pickup trucks than, let's say, San Francisco. Well, California's got a lot of farmland and so on, too. But let's take a state like New Mexico, which has also adopted the California standards. New Mexico is a ranching state. They have a much higher percentage of pickups and light-duty trucks on the roads there than we do as a percentage of our vehicles. They adopted the standards. They think they're reasonable. We think they'll be reasonable in Minnesota as well. I don't want to go into long detail about this. I have some experts here who can go into more detail. But this is a question of, are we going to take a step forward? We're not the leading state in this. There are 18 that have either implemented, adopted the California standards, or are in the process of adopting them administratively. But if we are going to take seriously those big step forward we did last year, and again, as I said, we did push the utilities forward, we think it's important that we address the transportation sector as well, in order to make sure that we don't put more of a burden on some industries because we didn't make the necessary steps in transportation. I'm happy to stand for questions, but I think it might be helpful if we have more of the testimony before that. And I have Jim Urkel from Center for Environmental Advocacy here.
Mr. Urkel, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I also served on the Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. One of the recommendations from the Technical Working Group that was accepted by the advisory group was that Minnesota adopt the California Clean Car Standards. I will try and explain the standards, how they were adopted, and hit on some of the points of disagreement that were raised both in California as well as within the working group's discussions. And I'll also try and put the recommendation into context by explaining how other states are taking action in regard to the California Clean Car Standards. I'd like to start, though, with a quick reminder of what climate change means to Minnesota. In the last century, Minnesota's annual average temperature rose by 0.79 degrees Fahrenheit, twice its natural range of variability. University researchers have estimated that global warming will increase Minnesota's average temperature between 2 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit. As a result, Minnesota may experience significant shifts in its ecosystems with resulting problems for Minnesota's farm and forest-based economies. We can already see that transitioning happening right now as the boundary waters rebound from the blowdown on July 4th, 1999. University researchers, again, have found that the forest communities that are coming back reflect more of the central hardwood forests of the eastern United States than they do the coniferous forests of the boreal north. Another way of explaining it is, based on that temperature difference, is that back in the 1990s, when the Twins were threatening to leave the Twin Cities, Governor Carlson, who was pushing for a new stadium, said that if we didn't do it, we would just be a cold Omaha. Well, with climate change, we will be Omaha. California was also concerned about similar effects of climate change on its economy and ecosystems. California believes that climate change has the potential to reduce the snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas, which supplies water throughout the state. It will adversely affect agriculture and food production because of a lack of water and outbreaks of pestilence. It will double the number of catastrophic wildfires that they will suffer and also damage the state's coasts. California also knew that passenger cars and light-duty trucks were responsible for about 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the state. As a result, the California legislature passed Assembly Bill 1493, which required the California Air Resources Board to adopt regulations to reduce transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions. The legislature directed the board to adopt regulations that would achieve the maximum feasible and cost-effective reduction of greenhouse gas emissions for motor vehicles. The legislation defined that term as meaning capable of being successfully accomplished within the time provided, taking into account environmental, economic, social, and technological factors, and economical to an owner and operator of a vehicle, taking into account the full life cycle costs of the vehicle. In developing the regulations, the legislature required the board to consider technological feasibility, provide flexibility in the means by which the regulations could be met, and grant credits for steps taken by manufacturers to reduce greenhouse gas emissions prior to the date that the regulations took effect. Importantly, the board could not require any mandatory trip reduction measures or land use restrictions, impose additional fees or taxes on vehicles, fuels, or vehicle miles traveled, limit or reduce speed limits, or ban any category of vehicle, or consider any reduction in vehicle weights. The breadth and detail of this legislative direction belies the claim by manufacturers that the board is somehow unchecked and running amok. To set the emission standards, the board worked with automobile engineering experts to model the reductions for five vehicle types: small and large cars, small and large trucks and SUVs, and minivans. With various packages of technology that already existed or that would be readily available in the timeframes that the board was considering. The board then tested the packages on the vehicle types of the manufacturer with the heaviest average vehicle weights in order to satisfy the legislative prohibition on not considering legislative weight restrictions. The board then performed a detailed evaluation of the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that could be achieved and the cost of achieving them. In the near term, the evaluation identified a number of technologies that were already in the market, such as cylinder deactivation, improved transmissions, variable valve timing and lift, turbocharging, direct injection of gasoline, and more efficient low-leak air conditioning systems. For the near term, they identified a number of additional technologies they expected to make it into the market fairly soon. Based on this work, the board set its standards to reduce transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions. The standards phase in between model year 2009 and model year 2016. The standards reduce the CO2 equivalent emissions for passenger cars and small trucks and SUVs from 323 grams per mile in 2009 to 205 grams in 2016. For larger trucks and SUVs, the reduction is from 439 grams per mile in 2009 to 332 in 2016. Result, large light-duty trucks and SUVs get to end at emission levels that are actually higher than what passenger cars start at. The board found that the standards will result in an 18% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the light-duty vehicle fleet in 2020 and a 27% reduction in 2030. Importantly, the board also found that the standards would result in reductions of criteria air pollutions as well. In addition to the phase-in period and separate standards for lighter and heavier cars or vehicles, the board also included a number of measures to allow maximum flexibility for manufacturers to meet them. The standards take into account and fully credit the differences in greenhouse gas emissions from alternative fuels, including the differences in upstream emissions, allows manufacturers to average emissions across their models, aggregate the different greenhouse gas pollutants, bank excess credits for subsequent use, and trade credits with other manufacturers. The standards also provide credit for emission reductions achieved between model year 2000 and 2008. The standards include a credit for improvements in air conditioning systems and a specific exemption for a portion of a manufacturer's fleet to account for work trucks. Manufacturers claim then, and I think you'll hear later on in this hearing, that the standards would restrict model availability because they wouldn't be able to sell large trucks and SUVs and still meet the fleet average standard. However, the standard was set by the board such that it could be met by all manufacturers while maintaining full availability of all models. Manufacturers also argued that the standards would restrict vehicle attributes such as acceleration, weight, and towing capacity. Modeling performed by the board assumed that while meeting the standards, vehicles would also maintain the projected model year 2009 performance levels. In fact, the board set up its evaluations specifically to avoid downsizing in order to satisfy its legislative mandate. Manufacturers argued that it's highly unlikely for them to meet the standards with vehicles that burn E85. There may be some practical difficulties, a chicken and egg problem for use of E85, but it was revealed in litigation last year that GM has already certified flexible fuel vehicles in California. Manufacturers also argue that the credit for use of E85 is impractical because it requires them to show that E85 cars actually, in fact, burn E85. In the same litigation, GM confirmed that it has an onboard diagnostic system which measures the amount of fuel passing through the system and the number of miles the vehicle travels and can send the operator a monthly email with information regarding the vehicle's fuel economy. There is no reason why a simple software change would not make it possible for such technology to also monitor and report the alcohol content of the fuel as well. It was based on this kind of evidence that the court dismissed the manufacturer's arguments as unconvincing, improbable, highly unlikely, and not credible. As part of its economic review, the board estimated that the incremental cost of control in the near term to meet the standards was $367 for passenger cars and small trucks and SUVs and $277 for large trucks and SUVs. In the midterm, the cost of control would be $1,064 for passenger cars and small trucks and $1,029 for large trucks and SUVs. However, the board also found that the upfront cost would be more than offset by savings in operating costs, as Senator Marty mentioned. When they were looking at this number, they were looking at they were cranking out the cost savings with a price of gas at $1.74, and found that on a typical five-year lease for a car that the incremental cost of control would be paid for within a year and a half. At $2.25, it would be a year. At $3, it's basically next week. Manufacturers argued that the board had underestimated the cost of control and stated that the cost would be more like on the order of $3,000 per vehicle in the midterm. However, the board had relied on a state-of-the-art evaluation of the technologies for greenhouse gas emission reductions. In addition, it heard evidence that manufacturers have historically overestimated the cost of control by a factor of anywhere from 2 to 10 times actual cost. Moreover, studies showed that the cost of control represent only about a third of the increase in vehicle prices and are often swamped by year-to-year variability in the market. Following its reviews, the board adopted the greenhouse gas emissions as part of its low-emission vehicle 2 regulations. Under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act, California may adopt such standards if they are more strict than the mobile source emission standards adopted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency if the agency grants a waiver from the preemption effect of the Clean Air Act. Under Section 177 of the Clean Air Act, other states can adopt California standards for which waivers have been issued by EPA. The adopting states need not adopt all of California standards, but whatever they adopt must be identical to what California has established. EPA has held that adopting states need not adopt portions of the standards which are considered segregable, and has held that fuel standards and zero-emission vehicles, or their portion of the LEV II standards dealing with zero-emission vehicles, need not be adopted by other states. A number of states have begun taking steps to adopt the California Clean Car Standards. At the moment, 12 states have adopted them. The Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group recommended, and the MCAG adopted, the position that Minnesota should join these other states in adopting the California Clean Car Standards. Manufacturers have argued that the standards are not appropriate given Minnesota's conditions. However, a quick study of the other states show that Minnesota's exceptionalism is not sufficient as an excuse not to move forward with MCAG's recommendation. At this time, I'd like staff to hand out a chart that I've developed that shows all of the states that have either adopted or are considering adopting the California Clean Car Standards. It contains a lot of information. It talks about what steps they've taken, whether it's required legislation or administrative action. It also shows the date on which they were adopted. I also have shown both the party affiliation of the governor of the state at the time of the adoption, as well as how the how those states turned in the 2004 election. You can see that there are a number of states. There are red states with red governors that have moved on this, blue states with blue governors, and red on red, or red on blue and blue on red, that have all moved forward with this. You can see the breadth of this in terms of the number of vehicle registrations. So they represent a substantial portion of the market already. I've also included the 2005 fleet mix, that is the difference, or the percentages between car and trucks. The thing to remember on this chart, though, is that the definition of trucks comes from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which includes SUVs and now the crossovers as trucks. So that means PT cruisers are included as trucks. Minivans are included as trucks in terms of those percentages. One of the arguments that we've heard from the manufacturers is we're going to be somehow harming the farming and the forest industries because they won't be able to use larger trucks. As I said, standards were set so that would not be a problem. But even so, based on this number, the last time I was driving around, I didn't see any PT cruisers pulling manure spreaders or hauling bolts out of the forest. The last thing that I've included is the portion of or the gross domestic product for each state, and you'll see that there are five have larger ag industries than Minnesota does: California, Florida, Oregon, Washington, and Iowa. And that's just on the pure dollar amount. If you look at this as a percentage of total state gross domestic product, there are five states that have proportionately bigger ag sectors, and that includes Iowa, Montana, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington. So there are lots of states that are moving forward, lots of states that have industries that rely on trucks, true, large, big working trucks. And it's clear from the evidence that was presented to the California Air Resources Board that those trucks will not be harmed. And, in fact, there are several that have already being produced as part of the model year 2009 that already meet the standards for 2016. That all. Questions you might have.
Questions for the witness?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, next we have Molly Schultz from Conservation Minnesota. And while she's coming up, I want to again stress that the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group studied this at length. And, again, all the debate and everything came through there, and they did recommend adoption of the California standards here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Schultz. I'm the Public Policy Director for Conservation Minnesota and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. The partnership is a coalition of 80 conservation and environmental organizations throughout the state, representing nearly 500,000 Minnesotans who believe that the protection of our lakes and our land and our air is at the very core of protecting our future. Each year, our members choose a few issues that they believe rise to the level of having the full force of the coalition behind their passage. We call it our collaborative or our priority agenda. Our members have some criteria in mind when selecting an issue. Among those are the impact it will have on the great outdoors, whether or not there's broad public support, and the timing, whether or not this is something that's right for the state to do at this particular moment in time. And the clean car standards, Senator Marty's bill, meets all of these criteria. First, the importance. According to the Pollution Control Agency, 25% of global warming emissions come from the transportation sector. This high percentage means that there is simply no way we can achieve our goal of reducing global warming pollution 80% by 2050 unless we address these emissions. The Governor's Task Force on Climate Change recommended that Minnesota adopt these standards in order to meet this goal. As for broad public support, we found through our polling and focus groups conducted this fall that the adoption of these standards is quite frankly a no-brainer for most Minnesotans. Over 80% of Minnesotans believe that these regulations are an important step towards reducing global warming pollution and that they are necessary to increase pressure on manufacturers to produce more efficient cars. Now, the support did cut across party lines, and other demographics such as age and gender, and support levels were similar throughout the state geographically as well. We conducted focus groups of residents of the western suburbs of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska, as well as residents of the Austin-Albert Lea area. These were ordinary people. They were selected by an independent marketing firm. They were not members of ours, or nor were they a self-selected group of environmentalists. And again, when we talked about this issue, we found strong support across all demographics and party lines. And in fact, it was interesting because they commented over and over, this is something that should have been done a long time ago. Simply put, Minnesotans want to drive cars that pollute our air less and use less gas. They know it's good for the air we breathe, for our great outdoors, and it helps us take a real step towards energy independence. We've also found in our polling and our focus groups that Minnesotans know that automakers have dragged their heels when it comes to producing cars that don't emit as much global warming pollution. The technology exists to do it, but automakers are not moving fast enough. Over and over, we heard members of our focus group say they aren't going to do it on their own. We have to make them do it. As it turns out, Minnesotans have a pretty good reason for their healthy skepticism of the auto manufacturers. It seems that their product development chief, the product development chief for General Motors, Bob Lutz, has commented repeatedly that he does not believe global warming is real. In an interview, he said that global warming is a total crock. This is very out of step with our members, very out of step with the things that our members believe, and is, we feel, something that we believe leads to a lot of discrediting of some of the things that they're going to try to bring forward today. It does give one pause when considering their reasons for continued opposition to these standards. After all, people don't really rush out to solve problems that they don't think exist. So what happens instead? Instead of progress and results, which our members are expecting, there is a long-running campaign of fear and misinformation. Even though all of the arguments you will hear today have been tried and disproven in other states and in several failed legal challenges, they are back here again to give you a long reason why auto manufacturers cannot manufacture auto parts. But keep in mind that every time this bill is introduced in a state, the manufacturers hire marketing firms and lobbyists to defeat it. And when that doesn't work and the bill's passed, they hire lawyers to sue. That hasn't worked either. I'm here today because Minnesotans know that it's time to sift through all of the disproven facts, the history of inflated cost estimates, and all of the failed legal challenges. They know that it's time to stop fighting progress, and it's time for the auto manufacturers to start employing engineers and mechanics who will develop and build these technologies. Think of where we would be right now if that was what they did back in 2002 when these standards were first signed into law in California, rather than tying up the court system. Our members hope that when you make your decision today, you will listen to their concerns for our planet instead of buying into a campaign of misinformation led by someone who does not believe our planet is facing a crisis. The global warming pollution from our cars won't just go away if we ignore it. And if we give the auto industry a free pass, we're going to have to ask other sectors of the economy to cut even deeper into their own reductions. We urge you to pass this bill and move Minnesota closer to a real and comprehensive global warming solution. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Ms. Schultz? Ms. Axog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schultz, what's the federal government done on pollution and vehicles? They passed a law this year, passed a bill this year, signed in a law that does some things. Do you fill us in on that? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, I will let probably Mr. Urkel give the particulars of the differences between the two. Our understanding is that the federal government addressed fuel efficiency standards, and that is different than emission standards from an automobile. And so there's a little bit of a difference between the two. We certainly think that the federal government took a first step towards what they need to do, but it has always been, up until recently, the state's rights to do something that they believe might be a little bit stronger if that's the need for their citizens.
Mr. Urkel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the Congress passed a new energy bill in December of 2007. It established requirements for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to set new corporate average fuel economy standards that would average ultimately 35 miles per gallon. And as Ms. Schultz mentioned, there's a difference between emission standards and fuel economy standards. The California standards deal with emissions not just from the tailpipe, but also from the air conditioning systems, which in many cases are running on material whose global warming potential is thousands times worse than carbon dioxide. So they have worked in a number of credits dealing with just the air conditioning system as well. But when you try and convert the fuel economy standards into emission standards, the California standards still end up having reductions of about 15 to 18% more than the fuel economy standards would have when you get out to 2020. In addition, one additional point, the other thing that the new energy bill does is that it eliminates the credit for E85 vehicle or for flexible fuel vehicles that exists under or that applies under the existing CAFE standards. So over time, the credit that manufacturers got for building E85 vehicles will go away. The California standards do not establish a credit, and that runs for as long as the regulations run. There's a question of how you prove up the use of E85, but that's easier to deal with than having the E85 credit wink out.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any reason to believe, though, that the federal government is going to do anything in terms of the type of legislation you're talking about here in the coming years, coming
Miracle.
Year?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is the EPA had been working on an endangerment finding for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and it's not clear, or at least to my knowledge, it's not clear whether they will begin moving forward, because once the legislation was passed, EPA called a very hasty press conference to deny a waiver to California to move forward with these standards. So I'm not sure where it has to go. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that the greenhouse gases are an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. They were required to find a finding of endangerment. That still may go through, but they may decide that because of the new CAFE standards that they won't move on it in terms of emission standards.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should have probably asked this before when we were dealing with the net savings, but just a question on that one handout where it talks about cleaner cars, where it talks about a savings to consumers due to reduced operating costs from consuming less fuel. Can you explain that a little bit? I kind of have this idea that fuel consumption is more based on the type of fuel. In other words, like if you're using E85, you get, you know, less mileage. Horsepower, you know, like if you got a big engine or small engine, and then kind of how we drive, you know, like if you go the speed limit of 55 versus 70 or something. Where does that savings to the consumer come in?
Mr. Urkel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the calculation of savings comes from the California Air Resources Board. I'm not certain how they crank the number, but I believe they took representative vehicles, looked at the difference in fuel economy, and then cranked it through a useful life for that vehicle, and at least through the notion of a 5-year lease, which is typical in terms of the use of cars, and it assumed the same amount of driving. It assumed the same, you know, everything other than the clean car standards and how the technology package that would be adopted for those cars would play out. So it ends up being a matter of having fuel, well, having a vehicle that is more efficient, driving the same number of miles.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, Senator Stump, you seem to be saying that one of the ways you can save energy is driving slower, driving smaller vehicle or whatever. And all of those are true as well. What the California standards are doing is they're saying we're using new technologies so you can be driving the same size vehicle, same weight vehicle, same horsepower, same speed, and you'll have a more efficient vehicle. That's where the savings are because of the newer technologies. And Mr. Urkel or others could tell you what some of those technologies are, but they are technologies that can use the same power of a truck, same speed, same everything else, and make the car more efficient, which is realistically what I think we all want to make sure happens.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the panel. You talked about 19 states moving forward with administrative process. Can you explain that a little better to me? Versus statutory?
Mr. Chair, Senator, a number of the states are, well, as an example, Florida, the governor, Charlie Crist, issued an executive order mandating their equivalent of the Minnesota Air Pollution Control District to adopt regulations that would incorporate the California Clean Car Standards. So they didn't need legislation directly to move forward with it at that level. I think the question you're getting to is whether they had underlying legislation dealing with air pollution, and I believe they probably did. I'm not certain of it, though. Colorado is another example. Governor Bill Ritter has received a report from Colorado's version of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. It included a recommendation to adopt the California Clean Car Standards. He is in the process of also issuing a – well, they're expecting that Governor Ritter will issue an executive order similar to Florida's in order to move forward. So it just depends on where each state is in terms of whether they have their own air pollution control regulations in place already, or if not, then they would need to do it through legislation. But there are a number of states that have that underlying statutory authority already and are just simply moving on an administrative level to adopt the Clean Car Standards.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that the Freon, obviously, in the air conditioning is probably one of the most toughest on the environment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is quite true, that those kinds of gases can survive much longer and cause much more problems than just carbon dioxide itself.
Thank you.
12 states have this?
Mr. Chair, 12 states have already adopted it. Two are in the process, Arizona and Florida. There are two that are waiting to kick it off, and Colorado is one of those. And then there are four that are in similar positions as Minnesota that have recommendations from climate action plans to move forward but haven't taken the next steps.
Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To add to that point, the states that have adopted it represent well over 50% of the vehicles on the road in the United States.
How many by statute and how many by regulation, by rule?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number broken out that way, but I can certainly get it to you.
Thank you. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Urkel, I have a question about the last point. Of the states that have adopted this, how many have actually implemented it? Are they allowed to implement it under the federal law? And I'm looking at the second page of the Strike Everything Amendment, and the phrase it says cannot become a Clean Air Act cannot become effective, and I'm paraphrasing, and enforced in Minnesota unless and until California receives a requisite federal waiver. I would conclude from that they're not allowed to be implemented.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Marty.
Senator Frederickson, that's correct. The EPA, which was a big surprise to people last year, rejected. It's been through the courts many times. The EPA at the last minute surprised people by rejecting it. However, among other things, we have the next witness is from the Attorney General's office. Minnesota's already joined in the lawsuit to overturn that. But regardless of what happens with the lawsuit, the last four Republican candidates for president, some of whom have dropped out of the race, and the last two Democratic presidential candidates have all committed to overturning the EPA's ruling. So in other words, no matter who wins the presidential race, they're going to overturn the EPA's – they're committed to overturning the EPA thing. So come January, the EPA waiver will be there. It's whether it's by lawsuit or whether it's by the new president, again, all the candidates of both parties have promised to overturn that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, wouldn't there be some rationale for waiting until next year to see exactly what has been waived and what we may and may not do and be in compliance with federal law?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the understanding of the Attorney General's staff can comment on it in more detail, but I believe it's a question, do we give them the waiver or not give them the waiver? It's not, well, we'll give a waiver on this or that. It's just the entire package. Will you accept that? And the 100%, I'd argue it's 100% certainty, not only because our Attorney General in 15, 18, 20 other states have gone in involved on this, and their attorneys say it's very – judging from past rulings, they'll win. But even regardless of what happens, again, the new president, all of the candidates who are in the running in a serious manner, all of them have pledged to overturn it themselves. So you won't need the lawsuit by that time if it's not resolved before then.
Well, there's a federal rule that says states can either adopt the EPA standard or the California standard. And that's and so states must choose between one or the other?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Neither?
That's correct. No, you have to choose. Well, you are default under the EPA standards. You have to choose the other one, which is what the 16, 18 states are doing or have done. But you cannot implement the California standards until the EPA waiver goes through, which will be January, if not before then.
Okay, so if a state chooses to upgrade, so to speak, to the California standard, then that still requires a waiver from the EPA.
Mr. Chairman, once California gets the waiver, we're all automatically included in it. Again, as I said, the Attorney General's staff is our next witness and can probably fill in more. But again, we don't require a state-by-state waiver. The only reason for putting this language in there was while the Attorney General's office is already joined in the lawsuit on this, just to make sure there were no concerns that we're going to face extra legal bills because of the fact that we were adopting this, and then they may add us to the lawsuit from the other side. So this is simply to say it won't take effect, because it can't take effect anyway. It won't take effect until after that waiver is granted, which, again, is, I'd argue, is virtual certainty, because all the people who make the decision after January 20th of next year have all committed to doing so.
And this is a EPA rule, or is it a federal statute that says that we can choose between the two?
Federal statute. Federal statute. Mr. Chairman, it's Section 177 of the
Clean Air Act.
Clean Air Act.
Okay. How far is Minnesota from being in violation of the Clean Air Act, or are we already?
Mr. Chairman, David Thornton from PCA could probably tell you in more detail, but we have had, certainly since 2001, a number of days in which we have exceeded the national standards. And over time, there is concern, and PCA has expressed this in a number of its reports, that we could be bumping up to the point where we would go into non-attainment for those standards. If that happens, a whole bunch of really bad things come down on us.
Okay. Senator Dill, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do. I'm trying to look at this chart here that you passed out, and maybe Mr. Urkel can answer this, but I believe you said 12 states had adopted the California standard. And when I look in column 2 under adoption, I count 13 check marks, which I believe would indicate that 13 states have adopted it. And then when I look at the states, they're either right up against the Pacific Ocean or they're right up against the Atlantic Ocean, New England or next to New York. Pennsylvania is one of them, which is, you know, a little bit, but the entire heartland from the Rocky Mountains to the Appalachian Mountains, practically, there's not a single state that has adopted the standards. So I'm that's part of my, first of all, I think, is it 12 or 13 states that have adopted it? And the second question is how come most states in the heartland have considered it or have adopted it yet?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have included California at the top, so that's it's 12 plus 1. That's where the 13 comes from. So it's California plus an additional 12.
12 states in addition to California.
California, correct.
That's
and in terms of left coast, you know, right coast or east coast, west coast, there are a number of states that have, on both sides of the country, that have decided to move forward with these standards. A number of them have done it because they have had worse air pollution problems than we have had historically, and so they are further down the track in terms of what kinds of actions they need to take in order to meet those or to improve their air quality. But in terms of something not on either one of the coasts, you have Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and even Iowa. Now, New Mexico has adopted them. Colorado is in the process of figuring out how to move forward with them. Iowa is in a similar place as Minnesota, which has a recommendation from their climate action plan. These are states that when you look at the importance of both agriculture and forestry to their economy, are fairly close, if not dependent on those industries than we are.
How many new vehicle registrations in 2006 in Minnesota?
$268,358.
Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. So we would probably be closest to the state of Washington.
Size. In Mr. Chairman, in terms of size, yes.
Okay. Senator Dill, did you have a follow-up?
No.
So why don't we take Ms. Heil? Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Appreciate your testimony, and you also probably heard some of the questioning, and if you've got thoughts or responses to any of them, well, we would certainly appreciate those in addition to your prepared testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Carla Heil. I'm Assistant Attorney General. I am the manager of the Environmental Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office. And I want to talk a little about why the Attorney General's Office filed an intervention in the California Clean Air Car Emission lawsuit. Let's first talk about, under the Clean Air Act, generally states can be more protective of the environment. They can enact laws stricter than the Federal Clean Air Act. However, for car emissions, the Clean Air Act said you can't. States generally cannot be more protective. Only California can. But then, in addition, if California gets a waiver from EPA, then all the other states can adopt California's. And so essentially the reasoning was they only wanted two types of cars, either those that met the federal standards or those that meet the California vehicle emission standards. And in the past 40 years, California has obtained 50 waivers from the EPA for their car emission standards. And I think what we were talking about today is the greenhouse gas emission standard, which California had adopted, but in December 2007, EPA denied that waiver. And that was the first time under this program that EPA had ever denied California's waiver request under their vehicle emission standard. The reason the Attorney General's Office intervened in that lawsuit to have EPA's decision overturned was essentially to protect Minnesota's interests if, in fact, California wants to adapt the greenhouse gas emission standard and the California car emission standard. That, as we said, there's two standards. Right now, we're under the EPA standards, which are minimal, and California does have a more stringent standard. And with that lawsuit, there are 12 states which have adopted it. Presently, there are a total of 19 states which are involved in the California lawsuit against the EPA. And we anticipate, the court has said, all the briefing has to be done in April of 07, so it's on a fairly fast track to get some decision out of the Ninth Circuit. And the reason the state intervened, what we specifically stated to the Court of California was, last year the legislature did pass the Next Generation Energy Act, and that does have ambitious standards. And so looking at the transportation sector and your climate change group, where they moved or recommended adoption of the greenhouse gas or the California car emission standards, The lawsuit allows you to adopt that if the court reverses that. Just a couple of questions on a follow-up. Senator Saxhog had asked a question about where the EPA is at, and I believe the other presenters talked about that the federal ones were car efficiency, not vehicle emissions. And just briefly, Massachusetts versus EPA, that was a case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court last year, where the Supreme Court said that greenhouse gases are pollutants, the EPA should regulate them as pollutants. And the Minnesota Attorney General has joined with 20 other states writing to the EPA director saying, you were supposed to take action based on this U.S. Supreme Court case. Where are you at in enacting these rules? And we have not gotten a response from the director of the EPA yet. But so, as one of the presenters said, EPA is not moving quickly to implement the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and the Attorney General's office is also trying to get the EPA to move more rapidly on that.
And that would presumably result in a higher EPA standard. But I guess the question that I have is how much and when?
Those questions, Mr. Chair, are unknown and are out of our control. And the role of the Attorney General, it is to preserve the options for the legislature, for the MPCA, on what standards, what's the most protective standard that the state wants to adopt on the vehicle emissions, whether it's the California standard or the waiting for a federal standard.
Questions for Ms. Heil. Did you hear the question about where Minnesota is regarding the compliance with the Clean Air Act?
Mr. Chairman, I will let David Thornton of the Pollution Control Agency answer that question.
So. Is Mr. Thornton scheduled to testify?
I don't believe so, but I know he's in the audience.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Frederickson.
I know Mr. Thornton's been before this committee many times. I think he could probably very succinctly tell us where we're at. So I'd like to hear from him very briefly.
Would you approach the table?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. Currently, we meet all the ambient air quality standards that have been promulgated under the Clean Air Act. So I would answer that question by saying, yes, we comply with the Clean Air Act.
Just barely?
Some of the standards were kind of close. As one of the speakers alluded to earlier, we have occasionally, in fact, just this last weekend, issue air alerts because pollution levels are predicted to be at or close to the ambient air quality standards. The two that we are closest to are for fine particulate matter and for ozone. Those are standards that EPA is reviewing right now, and likely to be recommending some lower numbers. They will make us closer still to the standards, but we believe that we'll still be complying with the new standards that they're going to be promulgating.
Senator Scobie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, are those particulates caused by auto emissions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in part they are. They're formed in the atmosphere mostly by a chemical reaction of different pollutants, and nitrogen oxide is one of the pollutants that plays a role in that, and that's emitted by motor vehicles. The fine particulate matter comes from a large number of sources. A lot of our fine particulate matter is blown in from emissions in other states. So it's a fairly complicated problem. If you've followed the air alerts, sometimes, in fact, I think this past weekend the alert was for southern Minnesota, not for the Twin Cities, and we believe in part that that's because pollution from the central part of the United States was encroaching into the southern part of the state.
Further questions for the witness? Senator Marty, do you have anyone else?
Mr. Chairman, no, that's the end of my list.
All right. Scott Lambert?
When are we supposed to win?
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Lambert. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. And thank you for allowing me to testify. We are opposed to this bill today. Mr. Chairman, normally you'd see my colleague, Alyssa Schlander, testifying. However, I served for 8 months on the governor's climate change advisory group while Ms. Schlander was on maternity leave, and it seemed to make sense for me to lead off today. And I'd like to start with comments about the advisory group. Mr. Chairman, because it's already been flagged here.
This is the climate change advisory group
that the governor put together over the summer and fall. And I sat on the same table with Jim Urkel on that as well. Mr. Chairman, I was on the Transportation Working Group. I don't think it's fair to say that the Transportation Working Group recommended this. In fact, there was a lot of controversy. At the end of the day, we produced a two-page dissenting opinion, and Mr. Urkel produced a two-page dissenting opinion, which basically made up the recommendation from the Transportation Working Group, and it was sent up to the full advisory group without recommendation. At the advisory group, there were basically three baskets. There was the of recommendations, and they looked at about 80 different things. There was the non-controversial, the consensus basket. There was a basket of items that were recommended, but had some questions, some objections to it. And then there's a third basket. And while technically everything that came to the group was recommended, I think it is, with all respect to Senator Marty, it is overstating the fact that in the third basket there was a lot of controversy. And this item fell in the third basket, where there was a considerable controversy to the issue. So while it was recommended, it was not an unqualified recommendation. And I believe that's why one of the reasons is not in the governor's final report. So I think it's just overstating the case a bit that this is recommended. Mr. Chairman, we represent the retailers in this debate. And us, along with the consumers, are caught in the middle between the environmentalists who want to impose a fairly large and, I would state, radical change in our industry, and the manufacturers who claim it can't be achieved. Now, I think most of you have been around the legislature long enough to know I rarely sit on the same side of the table with the manufacturers. And if Senator Marty should be congratulated for finding an issue where we can finally agree on something. We're actually here usually working against the manufacturers. But that being said, we are very concerned about the ramifications of Senator Marty's bill. This is all about, to go back to the early questions, is all about fuel economy. The California standards are separate and have been separate for a couple decades. But the recently enacted and not yet imposed fuel economy standards are what have us most concerned. For us, Mr. Chairman, it's simply a matter of inventory. We want to be able to have the product mix that consumers demand. The California standards move too far, too fast. It's just a simple matter of mathematics. The only way manufacturers can accommodate these aggressive new fleet average standards, is to remove trucks, minivans, and SUVs off the showroom floor. For every F-150 you sell, you got to sell a Focus. It's just that simple. While that may be the goal of some of the groups that have testified here, it would be devastating to our $11 billion industry and our 20,000 employees, and I think to the Minnesota economy as a whole. New Californian standards impose a 13 to 14% increase per year for 7 years. This is in comparison to the 35-mile-per-gallon standard enacted by Congress just this past December. It calls for an aggressive but achievable 4% increase. Mr. Chairman, the federal standards push the industry, and that's appropriate. The California standards push the industry over a cliff, and we are very worried about its ramifications. This is not California. California sells more cars than trucks. We sell more trucks than cars. We're different from California. We're a state that relies on agriculture, on forestry, on tourism. It's colder here. There's lots of differences between us and California. and to impose these new standards, unknowing of the ramifications because they're not enforceable law. And in fact, it's almost too bad that the waiver was denied, because then we could see the full ramifications of the action. As it is, we're left to assume that we will be beat up in terms of our product mix. If Ford stops giving F-150s to our dealers because it would put them over the standards, we can't go get them from someone else. That's it. Our dealers, especially in rural areas, they sell trucks. That's what they do. There aren't enough focuses in the market to sustain these dealerships. It'd mean we wouldn't have the product mix we need, and we'd have to be forced to either lay people off or sort of dry up and go away. Mr. Chairman, Congress acted to impose the new standards which we supported, and we should let those standards work. Let me tick off a few other concerns that we have with Senator Marty's bill. The imposition of the law would have the opposite effect for some time. Consumers would drive their older trucks longer. The best way to clean the air and lower CO2 output is to turn the fleet over and get older cars and trucks off the road. Mr. Chairman, I think this will mean a complete reversal of the state's ethanol policy, but there are other people here today who are going to speak to that. I won't elaborate. If we adopt this bill, we are abdicating air quality authority over to California Air Resources Board, an unelected bureaucracy that oversees air quality for an economy much different than Minnesota's. Mr. Chairman, the regulations governing the California Air Resources Board programs are wrapped up in over 1,800 documents. I had hoped to bring a copy in with me today, but it's too large, and I can't find a hard copy. Everything is online. And while I'm not an expert on the CARB regulations, I've been examining their website and found some interesting stuff. Now, I'll give the author the benefit of the doubt and assume we won't be adopting the leaf blower or hairspray regulations, that we're just going to deal with motor vehicles. But let me give you a flavor of the regulations that Minnesota would be embracing and regulated by California. Diesel vehicles, on- and off-road vehicles, farm and construction equipment, aftermarket parts, light, medium, and heavy-duty trucks, including their idling procedures and fuel mix, motor vehicle fuels of all types, dirt bikes, all-terrain vehicles, motorcycles. In fact, Mr. Chairman, if you rebuild motorcycles under the California regulations, you get to do it once in your lifetime. It's like Minnesota giving you a moose license. You get to do this once, and that's it. Buses, including public transit, school buses, annual certifications and labeling programs for everything I've just mentioned. It even regulates the paint placed on vehicles. All of these activities regulated by Californians, unelected Californians. Mr. Chairman, I think these regulations are a massive overkill and overreach. Minnesota does not have the air quality issues to warrant CARB's intrusion into our lives. And the gains in greenhouse gas savings over the existing federal program are small enough that I think they can be termed symbolic. And I would ask the committee to reject this idea and prevent the economic damage this could do to our state. Mr. Chairman, there are other people to testify, some from out of town. I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Questions for Mr. Lambert. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's a question for the senator, but you talk about the Governor's Transportation Working Group report coming out of there. Do we have a copy of that report? Is it included and I missed it or something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the report, by the way, I think I did say that there was controversy over it and they discussed all of this. I portrayed it as being a controversy, but they did recommend it. He comes out saying, well, they did recommend it, but they didn't really recommend it, which, I mean, I think it's fair to say what I said is accurate. It was controversial. They debated it. They did recommend it. And in terms of that recommendation, I have not gotten a hard copy of it yet. And again, it's a sort of a two-facing. The Climate Change Advisory Group came up with the recommendations. The governor's office is going to make his own recommendations based on some of them. I don't know whether this is going to be included in them. I've been told it might not be, but the commission, their votes did adopt this, and I don't know how many other total recommendations they ended up adopting, but
just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so when is something going to come forward from the governor's office, I guess, and going to be eventually carbon stone here? I mean, are we still in limbo there?
Mr. Chairman.
Maybe I can ask him myself.
Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gingrich, yes, you may have to ask the governor yourself on that. But, again, the Climate Change Advisory Group reported about, I'm thinking, a couple, 3 weeks ago or so, and the governor presumably sometime soon.
Thanks.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to kind of confirm that I was at the last couple meetings of the Climate Change Advisory Group. I was there on January 24th, I believe, when they did vote to approve the California clean emissions requirement. It was a divided vote, but it was definitely a majority passed it. And what we've heard from the governor's office is a preliminary plan to date. So they don't have – you can go on the Internet and look at the Climate Change Advisory Group, all the information. The final report isn't out yet, but it's all public record what the votes are that have been taken.
Mr. Lambert, did you have a –
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think we're all saying the same thing here.
Further questions for the witness? Mr. Lambert, who elects the EPA?
Mr. Chairman, the EPA is appointed by an elected official.
How about in California?
Chairman, the California Resources Board is appointed by the governor of California.
Is the EPA's bureaucracy big?
Mr. Chairman, I have no idea how big the EPA is. I assume it's very big.
All right.
We're all big.
Thank you.
Mr. Hyland.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Eric Hyland. I'm with Meserle and Kramer. And today I'm representing the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers, and I think I've got a handout that's going around. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 car and light truck manufacturers, including BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi Motors, Porsche, Toyota, and Volkswagen. With me today is Laura Dooley, also representing the Alliance. And we're going to run through, and we're going to try really hard not to be repetitive. And we're going to talk about what significant federal action has occurred and is current law in this country. We're going to talk a little bit about the significant workability issues between ethanol and Cal-Lev. I would like to point out the fact that the committee has removed the ZEV mandate is an acknowledgement of the fact that we have been saying, and I've also participated in the MCAG process, and we've been saying all summer, all fall, and all winter that there was significant issues dealing with the use of ethanol in California standards, and I believe the amendment to take that ZEV mandate out illustrates the fact that an acknowledgement that we're actually correct in that, and there are going to be some others not representing the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers that will also sound those same concerns. And then thirdly, what it really does mean when the Minnesota legislature turns over its regulatory authority to an unelected board in California who has got, quite frankly, a pretty sketchy history in terms of their use of ethanol and their support of flex fuel vehicles. So, but at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Laura, and she'll give you a little bit more detail.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Eric said, my name is Laura Dooley, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak to you all and encourage you to actually oppose Senate File 481. As you know, the bill calls for the implementation of the California Low Emissions Vehicle Program, and I'll refer to that as Cal-Lev moving forward in my testimony, as that's what we call it within the industry. Let me just start off by saying that the automobile industry shares the goals that are put forth in legislation such as this. We are looking to help produce a clean environment. We want to see energy independence, and we want to greatly reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are coming out of our vehicles. In fact, the industry has taken the lead in bringing innovative, clean, and efficient technologies to the market. Today, over 62 different models of alternative fuel vehicles are available to consumers. And when I say alternative fuel vehicles, I'm not just talking about flex fuel vehicles, but hybrids and diesels. And eventually, that will increase to technologies such as fuel cell vehicles that run on hydrogen and battery-operated vehicles as well. Nearly 12 million of these vehicles are on the road today, and Minnesota alone has over 200,000. While we share the goals of 481, we disagree on the methods of achieving them. The Alliance supports a strong, national, aggressive program such that was put forth in the Energy and Independence and Security Act of 2007 that was recently signed by Congress this past December. The centerpiece of H.R. 6 is a requirement that automakers achieve an unprecedented 40% increase in the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standard, also known as CAFE. That increase must be attained by 2020. As a result, we'll expect to see about a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions. And let me just say that that is the minimum standard that automobile manufacturers will have to meet. It could be determined later on in the regulatory scheme that that actually be increased, depending on the technological improvements that the industry has made before that time. This is far more than any other industry is being asked to reduce greenhouse gas emissions under any of the leading legislative pieces that are currently before Congress. In addition, H.R. 6 will reduce the nation's dependence on foreign oil and increase the production of clean and alternative fuels. H.R. 6 is estimated to save 18 billion gallons of gasoline per year by 2020 compared to estimated consumption levels, and that's a feat equivalent to taking about 30 million cars off the road. H.R. 6 also requires that the U.S. produce 21 billion gallons of advanced biofuels like cellulosic ethanol. What we don't like is the California Low Emission Vehicle Program, and that's why we're here today to ask you to oppose 481. The program virtually eliminates any incentives for E85 vehicles. It relinquishes Minnesota's authority to California. It establishes a patchwork of constantly changing regulations, and it virtually ensures that valuable state resources will be spent on far-reaching regulations as opposed to on promising technologies. The U.S. EPA also supported the national program set in place by H.R. 6 by denying California's request to implement its own fuel economy regulations as part of the existing CALEV program, and that's what we've been largely talking about here today. This action prohibits California and all other states from implementing California's proposed fuel economy regulations. Let me just go ahead and give you a brief overview of what the California program actually is so you have a good understanding of what we're talking about moving forward. There are three components to CALEV. The first component is what we call the Low Emission Vehicle Program. It's commonly known as LEV 2. LEV 2 regulates smog and ozone-forming emissions, the things that are coming out of your tailpipes. That'll include PM2.5, NOx, volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide, and all sorts of air toxins. Currently today, the federal program and the California program are pretty much the same. One will not provide an environmental benefit over the other. The second component to the CALEV program is what we call the Zero Emission Vehicle Mandate, which is essentially a battery-powered or hydrogen fuel cell car mandate. But as we already know, the amendment offered here today will actually eliminate the ZEV mandate from the Minnesota's regulation if you choose to move forward. And again, the third component, which is largely what's driving this debate, is the fuel economy standards that most people associate with CALEV. That's the reason why your MCAG was considering CALEV. It's the reason, largely the reason other states have gone forward. But again, let me reiterate that in today's current law, Minnesota could not implement that rule at this point in time. So in lieu of all the recent federal activity and all the recent state activity regarding greenhouse gases, the Alliance still believes that the California program is not a sound public policy choice for Minnesota. And I just want to go into a few explanations as to why. First, and you've heard this before and you'll hear it again from other constituents here, the adoption of CALEV will not support the state's commitment to E85 technology and infrastructure. It will actually constrain the sale of E85 vehicles. Should California Air Resources Board, which is the governing body in California that has authority over this regulation, continue down their intended path and actually update their low-emission vehicle program coming up this year, their intention is that every vehicle or the average vehicle on the road should meet what they call the SULEV standard, which stands for the Super Ultra Low Emission Vehicle Program. I didn't come up with these names. That's really what California did. So SULEV exhaust standards are what will be the norm, will be the average of vehicles on the road if it moves forward in 2008. Flex fuel vehicles cannot meet the standard. They have not certified to be able to meet the SULEV standard. In addition, should the proposed fuel economy standards ever be implemented, there is no practical way for manufacturers to get credit for producing or selling these vehicles under the California program. Again, the question is why. We would have to show, in order to get credit, we would need to provide proof that consumers are actually fueling and driving their vehicles on E85 gasoline. That's a task that is way beyond what the manufacturers are currently capable of doing. And in fact, an expert retained by California to testify on the issue of alternative fuels during some of the litigation over this issue actually stated under oath that it would not be prudent for vehicle manufacturers to rely on the sale of E85 vehicles to generate sufficient credits to comply with the greenhouse gas standards proposed in CALEV. Secondly, the California program will result in product restrictions. You're probably asking why manufacturers think HR6 is better than the California proposed fuel economy standards, and the answer is simple. California's program is too aggressive too soon for the time frame in which automakers need to design and put our vehicles in the showroom. The only cost-effective way for manufacturers to comply with California's program is to restrict the sale of specific vehicles. And in this case, it would be the restriction of sales on light trucks and SUVs, cars that Minnesota residents prefer in the market, which takes us to the next point. Minnesota's unique market will actually have a disproportionate impact on your state. Because Minnesota residents favor light trucks and SUVs, and we have an average of about 55% light trucks to 45% passenger cars, it will be that much more harder for Minnesota to conform to the fleet averages required under the California program. The California standards call for each state that are complying with the program to conform to what California designates as the fuel economy average. So in order to comply, manufacturers will have to pull the light trucks and SUVs out of the market. Previously today, we heard some folks say that other states who have moved forward with the CALEV program have even more disproportionate divides between passenger cars and light trucks, and that's absolutely true. Some states like New Mexico, have taken that number up. I think it's about 58% to 42% trucks to cars, and that's comparative to 49%, 51% cars to trucks in California. The problem being, you can't say that New Mexico is going to be fine. You don't know that Minnesota is going to be fine. This part of the program has yet to be implemented in any state across the country. So regardless of what other states have as their fleet mix, we don't know what the impact will be until this program comes to fruition, which we also don't know when that is. So the ramifications of this piece of the program have not yet to be seen, and we can only gauge that states that have even a larger disproportion of cars to trucks will be impacted that much more. Finally, Minnesota should not cede its regulatory authority to California. CALEV is a California program. It's designed by California legislators and regulators, and none of whom are accountable to Minnesota residents. By adopting CALEV, you're ceding your authority to a state that is vastly different and tying itself to all future regulatory changes. Divergent market trends, economy drivers, natural resources, and air quality concerns separate Minnesota and California. Additionally, California has not shown a commitment to ethanol in the way that Minnesota has, and that should be a very big concern when you're voting on this bill. Adoption of CALEV will not only affect the automobile industry, but it's also going to impact agriculture, tourism, forestry, construction, and certainly ethanol. Moving forward, the automobile industry has been handed a significant mandate through HR6 to achieve 35 mile per gallon fleet average by 2020. That is a challenging task that our engineers have to take. What we need now is to go back and to do the research and to put the technologies into place that will allow us to achieve that goal without being sidelined by the burden of complying with individual state programs designed to achieve the same end result. So with that, we ask that you please oppose 481, and then we'll be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Okay. That was brought up in one of the initial testimonies. Are minivans included in the definition of trucks?
It depends on the numbers that we're using. It includes light trucks and SUVs. So I believe minivans are in there because it's gauged due to the gross vehicle weight of the car.
Okay. And then it was also brought up that the fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE, federal CAFE standards, are different than emission standards. Do you agree?
Not in the case that it's been presented to you. When we split apart emissions and fuel economy within the California program, what we're doing is we're talking about emissions in the sense that we're talking about smog and ozone-forming emissions, the pollutants that come out of your tailpipe. The greenhouse gas portion of the CALEV program what proponents have been calling the greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Well, that's absolutely true. The program is attempting to reduce emissions associated with greenhouse gases. That largely includes carbon dioxide. 97% of the reductions that you'll see of the greenhouse gas portion of the California program will come from carbon dioxide. That is measured as a fuel economy rating. So when they say it's different, it's largely not. It's the same thing. The CAFE program at the Hill you've increased the corporate average fuel economy. The CalEV program is designed to do the same thing. It's measured as a fleet average of fuel economy ratings.
The point I was curious about, and to kind of plagiarize a term for Mr. Lambert, I thought I heard you say there was three baskets in the CalEV program. Mm-hmm. One deals with zero emissions technology.
Mm-hmm.
The other deals with... could you explain those three?
Sure.
Summarize those three again.
And Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful if you take a look at the back page of the handout. It kind of lays it out as best as we can, as complicated as some of these standards are.
Absolutely. Maybe to make it, Mr. Chairman, to make it clear, when we say the emissions portion of the program or the smog and ozone-forming emissions, we're talking about NOx, carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons. Those are the pollutants that go into the air and would create essentially pollution. When you move over to the ZEV mandate, which is no longer in consideration after today's amendment, the ZEV mandate is also an attempt to regulate smog and ozone-forming pollutants. However, it's done in a different way. It's done through a mandate on battery electric and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Finally, the greenhouse gas or fuel economy portion of the regulation is an attempt to increase or to decrease greenhouse gas emissions, and in turn will increase the fuel economy averages of new cars sold.
So you're saying that under emissions, that will become a super ultra-low emission standard in California.
Mr. Chairman,
or they're just considering it.
It's my understanding if CARB were to move forward with their intended path, they would be updating the LEV program. It's currently LEV 2. It would be moving to LEV 3. And LEV 3, the average vehicle would have to meet the super ultra-low emission vehicle standard.
Okay. All right. And you're saying the CO2 category is that's not applicable?
That is, currently it cannot be implemented due to the EPA decision to deny California's waiver request.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, to clarify a little bit more is that you've got, we don't have any empirical evidence of what adopting the CO2 standard does anywhere. And so I think that is what is raising everybody's cause for concern, especially in terms of our unique vehicle mix compared to California. Minnesotans have more boats per capita than California does, and a lot of people in Minnesota drive SUVs and trucks not because they want to, but because they have to. And talking about our vehicle mix and the effect of CO2s and comparing it to what's going on in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or New Mexico is very difficult because none of those states have been allowed to implement these CO2 standards. So there is no market force examples that we can point to. What we can tell you, though, is that should these standards go into effect, the only way the manufacturers can comply and meet those standards is to change the vehicle mix that's allowed to be sold in the state.
Questions for the witnesses? Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious as to how, if this bill is up before us as an elected body, why this is constantly being referred to as we are somehow ceding our authority to California by considering this bill. Could
sure,
you
Mr. Chairman,
that?
Senator Sieben. The reason is once you opt in, as was explained earlier, you have two regulatory schemes to opt into. Right now, we're regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's the federal scheme that Minnesota operates under. Senator Marty's bill, should it become law, would require us to adopt the California regulatory scheme for auto emissions. Once you do that, the state no longer has any choice other than they could change back to the federal standards. But once you adopt those California standards, every time California changes its standards, we have to change ours. We don't get to pick and choose which are the new rules that California might think up in the next couple of years that we can adopt or not adopt. We are committed to that regulatory scheme unless we decide to change and go back to the federal standard.
Mr. Chair, and sir, I certainly appreciate that, but I just think it's a bit of a stretch to say that as an elected legislature, if the legislature and the state would choose to adopt that somehow we're ceding our authority to California. I think that's, even though I understand your explanation, it's a bit of a stretch.
I don't see it any different than ceding our authority to the EPA. I mean, our elected officials voted to give states this option, go with the EPA or go with California. So that was an elected body that made that decision.
Mr. Chairman.
If you were going to make the argument about a bureaucracy, California's is probably smaller.
Probably. Mr. Chairman, I guess my only point would be that those appointed California folks are only accountable to the citizens and the elected officials of California. They're not accountable to Minnesota. And with EPA being an appointment of the President of the United States and accountable to a Congress that is duly elected from citizens of the state of Minnesota, I do think there's a distinction.
I would say that they're more accountable because if they do something we don't like, we can opt out of it. EPA does something we don't like, we can't opt out of it.
Senator Scogin, did you have your hand up?
I did, Mr. Chair, and maybe it may be for Mr. Hyland, possibly for Senator Marty. I'm curious what California standards and what EPA say about mining, forestry equipment, agricultural equipment. Do they set standards for that heavy equipment?
Mr. Chairman, California standards deal with passenger cars, light-duty trucks, and medium-duty vehicles. They don't deal with heavy machinery. They don't deal with ATVs. They don't deal with lawn blowers. The standards we're talking about are passenger vehicles and light trucks. That's what we're talking about here, and actually have an amendment drafted because of comments such as Mr. Lambert's about how, oh, yeah, this is going to be, you're going to be regulating all sorts of off-road vehicles and everything else. Have an amendment drafted that would make it clear that if California for some reason would choose to do that, which, again, they have never done, and they've been, again, they passed in 2002 the standards that they have kicking into effect in 2009. They've been very rational in giving plenty of time, but the amendment I had drafted would be one that would make sure that if California would jump into regulating these other vehicles, that we would automatically jump back to the EPA without any further legislative action. But the whole point of this, again, a lot of things being thrown out there, the standards deal with cars and light trucks, period.
I guess it's a fair question, Senator Marty's. However, how would impacted states, what voice would impacted states have in California's board during their, you know, when they're adopting new standards, you know, talking about the super ultra low emission vehicles that they're considering for 2008, what say do we have in that? As opposed to EPA, where we would probably at least have elected officials at the federal level who could weigh in.
Mr. Chairman, again, as I've said, that the California standards have every step along the way for 40 years now. Every time they move ahead, the federal government takes its time, but eventually, sometimes a decade or two later, realizes maybe California was right, and they tighten up their standards. And so, again, if California would decide to do something we think is irresponsible, obviously the way the California legislature would do it is they would direct them otherwise. In our case, we would opt our state back to the federal one. Going from past history, there shouldn't be a need to do that. But again, you got to recognize it could happen. And as you pointed out, we wouldn't have authority over the California board. We would simply opt back. And I'd be happy to support moving back to it because we're trying to pick the best of the sets of standards, and right now, clearly, the California ones are best. And contrary to all the talk about the E85 vehicles, I mean, we have a GMC 2008 Sierra 1500 already meets the 2016 standards when it burns E85. E85 vehicles have been certified in California, And I think, again, the reason a state like New Mexico, which has a higher percentage of trucks than we do, feels comfortable with this is they've listened to all the facts, they've looked at it, and they decided it was reasonable. And I think we should decide the same.
Mr. Highland, want to comment on the heavy equipment, or is that out of his purview?
Mr. Highland, on the heavy equipment question?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty's intent is very clear, that he intends to regulate only on-road motor vehicles. I would just point out to the committee that within Title 13 of California law, it essentially regulates anything with an internal combustion engine. Weed whackers, ATVs, recreational marine products, but that is the same chapter that we're talking about here. And I'm not Senator Marty's intention to include simply motor vehicles is a good one, but that doesn't mean that California could sometime do something in the future that would change what a definition of a motor vehicle is, for example.
Mr. Chairman, and again, that's Marty. Why the legislation refers explicitly to the vehicle regulations, and that's why I have an amendment that I'd be happy to have put on the bill that says if they expand their definition of motor vehicles at some time, that we would automatically revert back to the federal standards.
Okay. Let's complete our testimony first. Any other questions for the witnesses? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members.
Roger Moore, want to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout here.
Pass that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Roger Moore. I'm a farmer from Blue Earth and president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I'm also proud to say my family is invested in Minnesota renewable energy, in ethanol, biodiesel production, and in building wind turbines. First, let me be clear. We've long been and remain supporters of protecting Minnesota's environment, which I understand this bill is attempting to do. In the early 1990s, Minnesota corn growers pushed for ethanol-blended gasoline as a tool for solving our carbon monoxide problems in metro areas of the state. In trying to decipher the very complex California vehicle standards, questions have come up about how these standards would work in Minnesota. We ask these questions of you as a precaution against good intentions leading to unintended consequences. First, California gasoline is very different from Minnesota's E10 gasoline. California vehicles are certified to California gasoline. How would this work for Minnesota? Would we change our fuels? How would vehicles be certified to Minnesota E10 or to our eventual E20 blend or Minnesota B2 or other biofuels? Second, for its population, California does not have a large number of flex fuel vehicles because the methods they use to make it difficult to certify E85 vehicles. As you are aware, Minnesota leads the nation in E85, and Minnesota corn growers have invested millions in building this market. How would California standards impact E85 vehicle availability in Minnesota? Third, it has been suggested Minnesota could amend portions of the California standards to allow for renewable fuels and for other special conditions. It's our understanding that this may not be possible and states must adopt either federal standards or California standards. You can't have a different standard for every state. What is true? Can Minnesota adopt only parts of the California law? If so, should Minnesota propose that all vehicles be B20 and E85 capable by 2015? Fourth, as farmers, work pickups are an important tool to us. Some suggest vehicles like this would be limited or eliminated in later years of the California standards. Is this true? Last, We recognize E85 and biodiesel are important tools for reducing greenhouse gases and emissions like CO2. It's our understanding that California law stipulates that in order for automakers to receive CO2 credits for building alternative fuel vehicles, they must prove how much fuel their customers used in previous model year. We don't build cars, but I'm guessing this provision will be impossible for any company to plan production for, or for them to track in an accurate way. How do you see this working so we'll have more E85 flex fuel vehicles and biodiesel used, and these fuels are properly credited with reducing greenhouse gas emissions? Let me point out again that we're all here in interest of protecting Minnesota's environment. We raise these questions as a precaution against good intentions leading to unintended consequences. For these reasons, we ask that you oppose the SF-481 and delay taking any actions until you have answers to these vital questions and the EPA has spoken. Don't destroy the ethanol industry that we've all invested so heavily in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, I see on your board of directors for the NEVC you have several car manufacturers. What are they telling you about meeting some of these standards?
Mr. Moore.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd have to let the car company speak to that. I think they maybe already have.
Okay. I guess it was I thought that it's my intuition, and just explain this out for me, is that if emission standards were lower, there would be more demand for flex fuel cars, trucks, etc. Wouldn't that help the sale of E85 fuel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there seems to be a lot of confusion to this. And like I said, I don't think we know enough about it yet.
I'm not sure.
Not sure.
Senator Marty, do you have any?
Mr. Chairman, I did want to point out, California, I think right now, is about E6 in their fuel, but they are, the report from December of 2007 from California Air Resource Board State Alternative Fuels Plan talks about them going to E10, recommending them going to E10 and then E20, as Minnesota is, and also making E85, which they have basically no flex fuel stations that can take it. So you wouldn't drive one there with E85 fuel in it because it would be hard to get the fuel. But California is moving, despite what the auto industry is saying about how well we'll have trouble getting our vehicles to work that way. California is moving the same way we are in terms of ethanol, and as of December of last year, and as I handed out this picture earlier, you actually get extra credit for using a flex fuel vehicle in California. And again, this big truck when run on E85 already meets their 2016, their second tier of standards. So again, I think I understand Mr. Moore's concern, but I think that this is actually a very positive thing for E85 because, it makes it easier if auto manufacturers feel they can easier get the credits they need by using E85. They will want to produce more of them, and the Minnesota consumers, you got the chicken and the egg. Where do you get more E85 stations, or do you get more E85 demand first? And it's kind of has to go hand in hand. And we think that this bill, because it would be pushing more E85 vehicles, would help facilitate that rather than hurt it.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Moore,
why is it then that California does not have a large number of flex fuel vehicles at the present time?
He's trying to
I don't know, maybe they don't have an E85 standard. Maybe that's what they're kind of moving towards here with their lower emission standards is E85. I don't know, Ms. Dooley, Mr. Hyland, do you have any thoughts on this?
Mr. Chairman, I do. The issue regarding E85, and there are a couple of issues. There may be a lot of I don't know how many flex fuel vehicles there are in California. I can tell you that the last time I checked the Ethanol Vehicle Coalition's website, and it lists all the stations in every state where you could get E85. There were a grand total of 3 publicly accessible retail pumps for E85. So that's one answer. Obviously, especially in California, I don't know how California, under its existing regulatory framework, would expect a manufacturer to sell a flex fuel vehicle and only be allowed a credit for that sale of that vehicle unless they can prove to the CARB board that the consumer is using nothing but E85 fuel in that vehicle, and there are only 3 pumps in California. So, again, that gets back to the issue that Ms. Dooley talked about, which is there's no practical way for us to get the credits because how in the world are we going to know what our consumers are burning in their tanks? And, you know, previous testimony talked about a little black box that can tell the consumer everything. And GM may very well have that technology. I'm not aware that any other I don't know if any other manufacturers have. And I guess I would just raise another issue is how much information do you want these little black boxes collecting on you and your driving habits?
And Marty?
Mr. Chairman, again, in California, because there are, as I mentioned, virtually no E85 pumps, people aren't going to get credit for that. In Minnesota, where it's a different story, again, they will have the incentive to do it, and there are other ways you can indicate and prove that you're doing it. I think, frankly, in Minnesota, we work on such a thing where we trust people, and if they sign a statement saying they're going to drive a truck on E85, giving them credit for that, I can't see how we can't figure out some way other than Mr. Hyland's little black boxes. But I don't think we want little black boxes doing that, and I think there are ways to get people to keep their word here in Minnesota.
So, I mean, guess, Mr. Hyland, wouldn't it make it easier for Minnesota to comply with the California standards because we do have an E85 mandate here? We have an E85 mandate, therefore we have a lot of...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we don't have an E85 mandate.
Excuse me.
We have an E10 mandate,
excuse me.
Existing E10, and then by 2012, I think, the goal, we have an E20 goal that I know folks are working on to get to at least to essentially burn enough ethanol to displace 20% of standard gasoline in the state.
I apologize for that, but we have a whole lot of E85 stations, vehicles. We produce a lot of it. So doesn't that make it easier?
Mr. Chairman, does Minnesota have a more robust E85 infrastructure? Absolutely. It is probably the best in the country. But that being said, there are still areas of the state that don't have E85 pumps. And again, if the requirement is that if you purchase that flex fuel and you have to certify that you're only using E85 fuel in that vehicle, you might be driving and there's just simply not an E85 vehicle or E85 pump available.
Okay. Senator Olson, you had a question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, from the statistics you were saying, we're already at E10 in virtually everything. When California is only at E6, we're way ahead on E85. When is California going to catch up with us, and do we need to add something complicated if it appears that we're ahead of them?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Olson, assuming that was directed at me, California does not have the ethanol industry we have here. They are moving forward in this. The reason I mention that is just to make the point that we've been told, oh, you can't use these things. You can't have E85 vehicles. This is going to hurt the industry. I'm saying, look, if it's going to hurt the industry and you can't work it that way, why are they able to certify them in California as meeting those standards, and why is California moving that way? My point is not that we aren't ahead of them in ethanol, because we are. I think Mr. Hyland testified that we are probably number one in the country in terms of ethanol. All I'm saying is that the fact that 49 other states are behind us on that this actually fits in very well with the California standards. That's my only point.
But Mr. Chairman, why would we need to add another bureaucracy and rigmarole to go through if we, in fact, have people motivated and are moving that direction and are ahead of the game? I guess that's what I'm not sure I understand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, again, the reason we want to move forward is to address the greenhouse gases. E85 may be a small part of it. There's a whole lot of other parts of it. And we're trying to say, let's move forward on this the same way that we really did push the co-ops, the munis, the investor-owned utilities. We pushed them pretty hard last year to meet our standards. And I think we have to keep in mind why we're doing it, for our grandkids and their grandkids, and making sure we don't destroy. I mean, the articles about the moose in yesterday's paper and how climate changes affect them, we're trying to address those issues and saying that, well, someday we can change this. You know, we've got to move a little more aggressively to address global warming, and California has, the EPA has, this is no new bureaucracy here. It's a question, do we go California route or do we go EPA route? We have two choices. One of them is more aggressive in addressing the global warming issue, and I think it's critically important that we take it seriously. Yes, it's nice to see California moving in that way in E10 and E85. I'm only saying the point is that's one small part of the carbon reduction issue. One small part. And we're trying to say California's way ahead of us in other areas. They should learn from us where we're ahead. We should learn from them where they're ahead.
Senator Paraso.
Mr. Chairman, it's interesting to listen to the debate this long and not ask a question, but all the time I've heard people say, why should we follow California? Well, we could have a lot of questions that, you know, Senator Marty brings up one of the reasons he wants to follow California now. But I would think of a whole bunch of questions about their lifestyle, their driving patterns, and 100 other kinds of things that Californians do that we would never think of doing in Minnesota. And we could say to them, why do you? And how come we don't follow you? I think we have a little bit more sense than California. Sensible people here. The Midwest is a whole different culture from the West Coast or from the East Coast or even from the South. And so why do we want to question? Why would we want to even go and follow them? I can't find a good reason to say yes to it.
I think it was explained earlier, Senator Paraso, is that the federal law says that states can choose between
California. I heard it. Okay. But that doesn't mean we have to choose it.
No. Senator Fredrickson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment a little bit on perhaps why California doesn't use ethanol to the extent we do it. And maybe it piggybacks a little bit on the more senseless speech that Senator Parasol just gave. But about 15 years ago or so, California made the decision to go with the oxygenated MTBE rather than ethanol. They very much pursued MTBE rather than ethanol here in Minnesota. Senator Parasol, we had the good sense to pursue ethanol instead.
I remember that.
And in the process, the MTBE was found to leak out of the underground tanks that were installed in California because California did not require the improved, more better tanks that are required for MTBE. And the result is that MTBE, I believe, has been phased out in California because it polluted the waters of California. And now I don't know if they're attempting to implement more ethanol use in California or not. I'm no expert at all on California. I just know a little bit of the history of it. But it proved that we chose the right course in Minnesota, I believe, by pursuing ethanol as an oxygen rather than MTBE.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, just one comment. In terms of California, quote, lifestyle or whatever other things about California, I think we should always have the good sense to look at who's the leader in something and follow them. If California's got better fuel efficiency standards, well, I mean, if they've got better global warming standards, we ought to adopt them. If we've got better ethanol standards, they ought to adopt ours. We ought to look, if the federal government's got better standards than the other option, we should go with the federal standards. But we should look for the best and not be so confident that we're always best in everything, because we're not. Sometimes we can learn from others, and it doesn't mean you adopt every single thing about another state. All I'm saying is adopt one small part, and that's their global greenhouse gas emission standards, which I think make good sense for us to copy.
Further questions for the witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, just one clerk.
Mr. Highland.
Thank you. One clarification, and we've all talked about different standards and what if California changes their standards. As Ms. Dooley talked about the emissions standards of California, if they do as they are projected to do and go to a LEV 3 emission standard, then that my understanding is that vehicle that is compliant under existing California regulations for 2016 in a flex fuel model might not make that same certification. So that's why I'm raising this as a caution, because California may or may not change its rules in such a way that will affect the use of flex fuel vehicles. And I would be remiss not to remind folks that this is an industry that has been regulated for carbon for 30 years that no other industry has. Our CAFE standard is an effective carbon dioxide standard. And the action that the Congress of the United States took this last year, which I will argue in large part is from a lot of pressure that other states have been doing, Congress listened, and it's the most aggressive increases in CAFE standards. It is a 40% increase in the standards by 2020, which equates to a 30% reduction in CO2 by 2020. And California is claiming a 30% reduction by 2016. And I guess the point would be, if you're getting to the same end, but the industry just needs a little bit more time and you're not disrupting the market force and you're not turning over your regulatory authority to someone other than Congress, is that benefit worth the cost?
Mr. Urkel, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that this vehicle is already meets the model year 2016 standards, but what's being talked about is if additional standards are adopted by California, which would fall into place for 2017 through 2020, and so it meets the 2016 standards. It may not meet the 2020 standards. They may have no car that meets the 2020 standards now, but within that time period, they might. But they're mixing and matching their arguments, because they're on one side they're claiming that Pavley 3 is going to apply, and then other times they say it doesn't. So, and on in terms of the 30% reduction, you know, they're claiming it through 2020. California claims it through 2016, and then they say it's basically the same. But Pavley 3 would take them up to more than 40% reduction by 2020. So there's mixing and matching that's going on here. And the fact that they can meet standards today on the California standards for 2016 has no impact on what ends up happening in 2020.
Senate File 481 is laid over for further consideration.
Meeting's adjourned.